everybody. It's The Information's 411, your weekly podcast from the reporting team at The Information. This is Tom Dotan, your weekly host. Here's what we've got on tap for you today. First off, I am talking to Jessica Lesson about the big shakeup or executive change or what exactly at Disney. Earlier this week, Bob Iger, the CEO, announced that effective immediately, he was stepping down as CEO and into a role as executive chairman. And in comes Bob Chapek, who'd formerly been the head of parks and products, consumer products. And it was a surprising move on many fronts, both the person that was chosen and Bob's decision to do it effective immediately and kind of step into this other role. It's all actually a bit complicated. And so Jessica Lesson and I get into the details and look into what the future holds for Disney. Then I'm talking to Priya Anand about Amazon Go. She had an interesting analysis piece about Amazon's decision to consider licensing out its Go tech to other retailers, but this gave us an opportunity to dive into the whole Go phenomenon at Amazon and what the future of these employee-less, cashier-less grocery stores are. That's the show for this week. Pretty exciting stuff. Hope you guys are all, I don't know, washing your hands or shaving your facial hair, doing all the things that you're, I guess, supposed to be doing at the eve of a potential global pandemic. Nothing to be scared about here. Well, hope you're all inside and enjoying podcasts. And now let's get to my interview with Jessica Lesson. All right, Jessica. So sort of on Tuesday, it was kind of a bolt out of the blue. I was at lunch. I was not by my battle station. It's just a surprise announcement. It's markets closed that Disney has a new CEO, effective immediately. Bob Iger was stepping down, kind of, more stepping up into this new role. And so they have this new guy, Bob Chapek, who is a little bit of a surprise. There's a lot to kind of unpack with the whole decision and the characters involved. But right off the bat, I mean, what were your thoughts? Just let's just start off with the pick, kind of a dark horse candidate and Bob Chapek.
Yeah, it was an interesting moment. I mean, big picture, the question of who the next CEO of Disney is certainly one people have been talking about,
yeah,
written about, you know. So, but yeah, the surprise decision, effective immediately, and then actually what was announced was certainly a little bit of a jolt. My take on this still is, I think, what your instant take was in your journalism. Not that much has changed.
Right.
Now, you still have Bob Iger, who is in charge of the creative vision of Disney, and the boss of Bob Chapek,
right,
who is the CEO and whom everyone else reports into. So, I mean, maybe this isn't to say, yes, it is a passing of the torch. It's further evidence that Bob Iger is going to leave the building,
yes,
eventually. We have to remind people that he had said he was several times and changed his plans. So it's sort of new on that front. But the structure is still very interesting.
Yeah.
And, Bob Iger remains Bob Chapek's boss. He remains in charge of the board. And I think in many ways, you know, not as much has really changed. Now,
right,
I'm sure it feels like it has in the sort of inner sanctum of Disney, but
they clearly wanted to be as transparent, but as clear as possible that he is the CEO. And that was,
yeah,
an issue with the last time they went through this whole thing with Tom Staggs, who was COO, and it felt very interim. But the irony of it is that, so he has the CEO title. It was effective immediately, which I know turned a lot of heads in the entertainment industry because it just raises questions. What happened? Why effective immediately? Usually you kind of give a lead time to it. But it really is kind of a COO type role. He's managing the business while Bob is doing creative. That was his responsibility, which is kind of a huge part of the company. It's not like a small side part.
Yeah, and there are a lot of things to unpack for different audiences. I mean, one, for people who maybe don't follow the sort of blow by blow of Disney, I think one reason we're talking about it now and that this got decent but not a ton of attention is, you know, Disney's a hugely important company, and both in terms of its success in the media business, its global brand. And, you know, I think as it became clear that Bob Iger was, you know, not going to be CEO of Disney forever, there was also this collective, you know, brainstorming a little bit. And you heard a lot of buzz years ago about outsiders like Sheryl Sandberg, Facebook, who was then on the Disney board.
Right.
You know, more recently, there was more buzz around other external people. And so I also think that part of it was this was really a position and a leader to watch. I think a lot of people in a lot of industries cared about it, were curious. And it was kind of like a shrug.
Yeah.
And I think that was interesting. I also, as a business reporter, like kind of comparing management structures. I guess that's sort of a wonky interest of mine. But I'm just sort of interested, like, where have we seen things like this before in media and tech and industries?
Which aspects? Like the passing of the torch or the arrangement of executive
chairman?
Well, this
kind of arrangement, right? So I guess I was sort of searching for what is this like, right? That we've seen before. And so you brought up, I mean, Disney and Iger in particular has a history of, you know, sort of promoting a number two, not always.
It was a disaster. It was an disaster. Unmitigated disaster.
Yep.
Last time.
And Disney itself, you can look at Eisner, Michael Ovitz. And I mean, so we see, I guess, in corporations, often the sort of elevation of the operational two is sort of a tryout for the top job. This isn't that. They gave him the top job, yet it kind of is that because they didn't give him the ultimate control. I'm wondering, you know, is it like when Larry Page ascended to the top of Alphabet and turned over the keys of Google to
Sundar?
Well,
so that's an interesting thing to examine because that happened a couple of years ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
A year or so
yep.
ago. And that to me, I mean, in that arrangement, how did that work? How involved, as far as you know, were Sergey and Larry, or Larry specifically, in, you know, the Google business while they were doing the kind of highfalutin stuff that they're interested in?
I think it depended. And ultimately, the reason that more recently we've seen Larry Page turn over and the CEO of Alphabet to Sundar is because there were still aspects of that job that he didn't want to do. He was dragged into, I believe, some of the regulatory issues more than he wanted to be. And perhaps that's where the ultimate parallel is, right? I mean, I think if you look at what Bob Iger is doing right now is, you know, my read of it, he's sort of saying, look, there are a lot of parts of being CEO of Disney that I'm just done with.
Yeah.
That I don't want to do anymore.
You deal with coronavirus in the parks.
You deal with, the pomp and circumstance that goes with being CEO of Disney. I mean, I think, and you get a glimpse of this from reading his book, which I did, right? There's a lot to do.
Yeah, it's an almost political appointment.
And so I think, you know, in the same way that when Larry Page sort of looked around and said, you know, I really want to work on flying cars and self-driving cars and a couple other things, I'm going to create a role to do that. I think there's a big element of that going on with Iger.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. The interesting part of that comparison, too, is that there wasn't a specific end date in mind with Larry and Sergey with their arrangement. Right. It was just theoretically could have gone on indefinitely, whereas Iger seems to, at least, and I think we should believe him at this point, you know, there is a specific end date, you know, at the end of next year.
And I imagine, you know, I mean, in some ways, so I think this, there's a lot to sort of admire in the move as well and how cleanly it was done, right? You avoid a lot of internal speculation.
Right, which was distracting, which was incredibly distracting.
Which was very distracting. You know, I know when his book came out, we were hearing from people inside Disney, everyone was reading it for clues,
yeah,
right, of who the next CEO is going to be. And you avoid press leaks, external, you know, and you make it clean. As for why it was effective immediately, I mean, one point of view is it's not that much of a change, so why not make it effective
right.
immediately?
Right.
Now,
why in 6 months should we say we're going to have this bizarre, you know, first
I'd love to know if Iger's sticking in his office. You know, I don't know the answer to that, but
it's a big office, like literally, it's a large office.
I think, you know, that there's a chance of that. And look, if as a way to pass the torch, you can sort of see the logic of it. Yet it is still unusual, and it's raising a lot of questions. And I don't know, one last one for me it's raising is, you know, there's just so much talent out there in the world too. And, you know, you look at these big companies that become, you know, they're these entities in them of themselves. They're so unique, and they do groom their talent from within over very long periods of time. And I think you can understand why they do that. I just also hope, you know, for the sake of like the future of business as well, that we find a way to bring in new leaders and more diverse leaders,
right, right,
to some of our countries and the world's most important companies. Yeah. And maybe that's,
you know,
naive, but this would have been a very awesome moment to see that, right, and we didn't see it.
Right, and it just is a behind the scenes for us. I mean, around the time that this decision was announced, I had been working on a story trying to put together a list of outside candidates, yeah, that could be, you know, theoretical CEOs and also ones that could tick those boxes of being more diverse and more just something different than what Disney had. And, you know, he didn't go that route. For whatever reason, it didn't happen that way. And you know, just last things here for me, the decision to make it effective immediately and really as a bolt out of the blue, my guess is at least partly was informed, and we'll do more reporting we'll get you the full story, is to avoid drama, right? Is to kind of just get it out there, have people sort of be shaken up for a bit, and then everyone just sort of accepts it and moves forward. I don't think it's going to work that cleanly. I think drama will transpire post this for a number of reasons that we can get into at another time. And so to me, the biggest question going forward is like, what's the fallout from this decision? Mm-hmm. Who's going to be affected by it internally? And of the various things that Bob is going to be working on now, you know, how successful is he in terms of, you know, working on creative, which is a huge portion of the company.
Yeah, and you know, more reporting to be done, but obviously big questions around Kevin Mayer,
right,
who, very senior executive there, runs the direct-to-consumer business, had been talked about as a potential CEO, some skepticism because he's sort of known as, quote, a deal guy.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, at the same point, Iger, in many ways, defined his CEO-ship through big
completely,
deals. And so, you know, as people like that stick around, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
And, you know, I think it remains a fascinating company, has absorbed Fox's entertainment assets. And, yeah, there's a lot to watch. And I think, you know, as someone put it to me, and I don't know that I actually believe this. I mean, I think Chapek is the new CEO of Disney, but there is also a sense of we may not really know who the next long-term CEO of Disney is. And I know the company probably will get mad at us for saying that, but, you know, that's our, you know, that's sort of the vibe out there.
Right. And these are the questions that I think that get prompted when you do it the way that they did it and the history that they have. All right, Jessica, I know we'll be talking more about this year, but thanks for joining.
Thanks, Tom.
Let's talk about Amazon Go, which I found out a couple of weeks ago is not something that everybody knows about. Even in San Francisco, I was talking to my wife about it, and she had never been inside an Amazon Go store before. And I explained it to her, and she's like, wow, that's incredible. And it is pretty neat. You know, we have a couple around our office in San Francisco. And
usually empty if you go during non-peak hours outside of like breakfast and lunch.
Yeah. But as a technology, it is impressive. As a business, as you've written about before, it's troubled. And Amazon runs into a large number of hurdles as they've tried to expand it. Just like looking at where Amazon Go is today, what's the latest on that business and what Amazon wants to do with that whole concept?
So they opened their largest Go store yet, a grocery store that's a little over 10,000 square feet in the Capitol Hill neighborhood of Seattle this week. And that store, we had written in the past about how they were planning on making it a Go store. It would be their largest, you know, cashier-free checkout experience store yet. All the rest of the Amazon Go stores are like basically 7-Eleven sized. They're pretty small. They carry snacks. They carry some local breakfast and lunch kind of items and peanut butter and stuff. They're not huge though. So this store is actually a pretty big deal for the grocery industry. Retailers are definitely afraid. that Amazon's come out with this like experience that works in a larger format grocery store. That said, 10,000 square feet is still not as large as Safeway.
What is that, like a large bodega?
The average Safeway, ShopRite, Wegmans, whatever grocery store you want to pick, the larger format ones, those are usually like 30 to 50,000 square feet, I believe. And this Amazon store is like 10,000.
So it's one third of a Safeway.
So, okay. Yeah. Which is like basically the size of a Trader Joe's, maybe, yeah. Depending on where your Trader Joe's is located, since they can really vary a lot depending on what city you're in. But yeah, it's like a smaller format grocery store, definitely bigger than a convenience store. And what they've done is they've figured out how to make this tech work where people can pick up like a loose apple or a banana or whatever. And the tech will understand that it's an apple or a banana and it'll just charge them by item instead of by weight. So it's a little bit hard to see how you scale that with like all produce items. It does sort of change the game if you start doing that. But regardless, it's a big move for a company like Amazon, right? There are questions around like, will they one day retrofit all their Whole Foods stores with this kind of technology?
Sure.
That I think is like, I don't know, there would be a lot of problems because these ghost stores have such intricate technology and they have sensors like in the shelves. They have stuff in this. They have cameras all over the ceilings. There's so much going on that it's hard to see how you would put that in a store after the fact instead of building them from the ground up. And this is part of why Amazon's run into challenges with expanding these stores, right? By the end of last year, they were hoping to have several multiples of the number of stores. And instead, they have like 2 dozen stores right now, which is very far behind the goals that they had initially set.
And what specifically is holding them back? Is it just the technology isn't scalable? It can go wrong in so many ways that it needs to be perfected in each location before you can open it to the public?
What's been sort of surprising to me is like how kind of like mundane and operational their problems are. And you would assume that if you're in physical retail, like these are obvious challenges that you're going to face. But because of the way their tech is set up, they need ceilings to be a certain height. They need a certain amount of, because Amazon Go is pretty new and it's an experiment and they're relying on this idea that people should be able to just like walk in and walk out with whatever they need. They've experimented with a bunch of different formats, like how can we get a store in the right neighborhood, because you need it to be, they don't know yet, or at least as of, you know, last year, they weren't really sure if these stores were really a destination. Like, would people drive up to an Amazon Go convenience store and like walk in to do their shopping and drive away?
So it's interesting. I mean, all you're talking about here is, like you're saying, super mundane operational things. It's not like the technology itself doesn't allow for this to proliferate to as many stores as they can.
I mean, Go is also very expensive, right? And they said that they have, so one thing Amazon, we reported this week, and the Wall Street Journal also reported that they're planning on licensing this tech out to other retailers.
Sure.
And Amazon has said, and we've been told that they have gotten the cost down a little bit as they've, you know, worked on Amazon Go over the last like 2 years. They've been working on making the tech more efficient and finding ways to bring the cost down. So part of their pitch to other retailers is like, look, like if you use our Amazon Go technology, we've brought the cost down so much more than if you were to try to do this yourself. But that said, there are lots of startups in the space that say, at least some say, that they're equipment that they're using to do something similar is much cheaper. So the question is, like, why would another retailer work with Amazon, right? But for Amazon, licensing out to other retailers is a way to expand Go and make more money off of it and maybe not have to deal with all the things we've reported are problems for them in expanding.
Do you think for Amazon, Go has reached this point where it's past just a prototype or experiment and it really is a business that they want to exist? Or is it still kind of in that Amazonian phase of like, no, we don't know, we're still kind of messing around with it?
I mean, Go is by far the most interesting thing Amazon is doing in physical retail. And Jeff Bezos had for years and years said that Amazon wouldn't get into physical retail unless it was doing something special and different from other retailers. Lo and behold, they bought a Whole Foods, and like Whole Foods is pretty similar to regular retail, right? And some of these other stores also, it's unclear what the strategy is. So Go, I think, strategically is pretty important for them. The question is, like, you know, will other retailers actually want to license this from Amazon? I think the fact that Amazon wants to do that signals that they're trying to turn Go into something more of a business rather than just this expensive experiment that they're showing
off. And yet let other people take some of it off their hands, right?
I think that clearly, you know, if you're outsourcing in a way and licensing this tech to some other people, you're taking away, it's clear that Amazon will be taking away some of the headaches it's dealt with and expanding. Yeah.
I mean, it's again, as
that have held them back from expanding.
As a user of it, maybe even once a week, I do find it compelling and I like their selection and I probably don't pay as much attention to price. So there's something interesting psychological happening when you sort of grab something and walk out with it. But I do wonder whether this is something that it'll just kind of be an interesting feature in a couple of urban areas or it actually becomes something much more.
In talking to people in the grocery industry and who work with retailers, one question that was raised to me is like, for any big grocery chain, is this kind of technology actually going to make a difference in foot traffic and how many customers come through the door? Because when
or in cutting down costs, right, by not having employees, as many employees.
Yeah. I mean, when someone comes to when the average, you know, parent goes into a grocery store, are they going to care about saving, you know, 5-7 minutes in line? Or are they going to want to make sure they have the every single item that they possibly wanted at their disposal that they needed to get for their like family grocery run in that week, right? So can you get this kind of tech into stores that are much larger format and kind of like change the game there? I think that's still an open question, though it seems like Amazon's move here signals that they're thinking about going bigger and bigger. Yeah.
What's your favorite thing at the Amazon Go store?
I've got to say a lot of the trendy snacks I'm not as into because I feel like if I want a bag of carrots and hummus, I will pack my bag of carrots and hummus and
that's
not pay like
snack?
$5. I don't know, like these yogurts and the overnight oats that are sold for like $6. Like, come on.
Yeah. I don't
know. I will make my own jar of overnight oats are mush.
One day at a moment of weakness, I'm probably going to get their cupcake in a jar thing. It sounds disgusting, but I also see it every time and think maybe today's the day.
And those are also like, you know, kind of expensive for what they are. And I'm like, do I really need this jar of sugar right now for several dollars and to succumb to that? I don't think so.
We'll see. All right, Priya. Thanks for joining.
Thanks.